Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Thailand has declared a two-month state of emergency in Bangkok and surrounding provinces in a bid to prevent an escalation of anti-government protests. Among other measures, the decree allows security agencies to impose curfews, detain suspects without charge, and censor the media. Anti-government protesters have shut down seven major intersections in the center of Bangkok for a week and a half. Samantha Hawley has more from Thailand.
Bangkok and its surrounds are now in the hands of the police and military. Curfews, arrests without charge and even media censorship are now all a possibility. After a cabinet meeting, the Thai government's imposed a state of emergency in a capital engulfed by political unrest. The anti-government protests continue in central Bangkok, but daylight grenade attacks and nightly shootings have led to this decision. On the other side of this unrest, there are government supporters who are said to outnumber their opponents and are known as the Red Shirts. I visit a shopping complex in Bangkok's north where the two top floors have been gutted for Red Shirt supporters to occupy. It's a desolate place and security is tight and tough. Dressed in military khaki, wearing dark shades and black beanies, the guards look less than inviting. On small televisions dotted around the space, people watch their leaders on a cable television channel dedicated wholly to the pro-government cause, Red Shirt TV. There too, in a large room, people gather daily for a Bangkok situation update. This man tells me he's come along so he can understand more about democracy and how it's going in Thailand. I've come here for a daily update about the truth and about what's happened, this woman says. In a small room, just larger than a closet, I sit down with one of the leaders of the Red Shirt movement, and a government MP, Dr. Wen Totarakan.
Well, you know, this country, my beloved country, so have so many sad, so many bitter history.
And it's history that seems to be repeating itself. A state of emergency was last imposed here in 2010. A military crackdown on Red Shirt activists saw more than 90 people die. And Dr. Weng tells me he's concerned about the prospect of a military coup. If it happened, it'd be the 19th since the 1930s. But he tells me it wouldn't be bloodless.
If you did another coup, how much people can you kill? 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 or 1 million?
In Bangkok, it's hard to find anyone willing to predict the outcome of this latest unrest. But most people agree there's no end in sight.
Samantha Hawley reporting. Malaysia's civil society groups have launched a new anti-corruption watchdog. The Center to Combat Corruption and Cronyism, known as C4, is a response to the growing public concern over rampant corruption. Kandahar Sapati has the story.
The issue of corruption in Malaysia has been dealt in passing by a number of human rights NGOs. But the Center to Combat Corruption and Cronyism, or C4, is the first civil society group that will focus solely on corruption. There is an official anti-graft watchdog, the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, or MACC. But as a statutory board established by Parliament, it is not effective in dealing with high-level corruption, says Cynthia Gabriel, a co-founding member of C4.
Over time, it has been found that the MACC has not been able to properly address these scandals, mainly because of the lack of powers given to them in the MACC Act, and that they are unable to prosecute because the recommendation to prosecute and the powers to prosecute lies with the Attorney General.
Corruption is present at all levels of Malaysian society, but in recent times there have been some prominent cases, including the National Feedlot Corporation, the Port Klang Free Zone, and the controversial purchase of 2 Scorpene submarines from France. 2 former ministers involved in the embezzlement of some $3.8 billion in the Port Klang Free Zone project have been acquitted by the courts. And the controversy still swirls around allegations of kickbacks and bribes in the Scorpene submarine purchase, which was signed off by Prime Minister Dato' Sri Najib Razak, who was then the Defence Minister. Cynthia Gabriel says C4 is the civil society's response to what is becoming an endemic problem.
This is a collective effort by the Malaysian people to actually lend their voice to the growing concerns on corruption and to also put pressure on the government to meet the minimum standards that they have put in place in order to meet good governance practices and to ensure that the compliance with the UN Anti-Corruption Convention is also met.
It's not surprising that the people are becoming discontented. After all, while they are being told to tighten their belts to deal with rising costs, public figures are seen spending lavishly on birthday and wedding parties and using government jets for private purposes. Edmund Bond, the former Bar Council president who is C4's legal advisor, says corruption is violating people's rights.
Corruption is seen as a type of violation of economic rights of the people in general. It increases prices, increases goods. The Auditor General's report every year reviews this, whether it's corruption by way of bribes or corrupt payments to abuse of power or negligence, which causes prices to inflate. All these come within that purview or the ambit of corruption.
Right now, Malaysians are actually faced with an increasing cost of living. More and more essential goods have actually gone up in terms of prices. And many people are starting to relate the issue with corruption because of the amount of money that has been misused and mismanaged. And if only that was not the case, then the burden would not be passed on to the public.
Cynthia Gabriel, how the government is going to react to this new civil society grouping has yet to be seen. But Cynthia Gabriel hopes they will receive them with an open mind. After all, Prime Minister Najib Razak has made the combat of corruption as one of his national key result area.
The very objectives of our centre actually meets what the Prime Minister himself has been saying. But there is a question of political will now, whether what he's actually saying and what he has put in as part of the priority of the government to combat corruption can actually be done. And I think this is where civil society response, which is more collective, which is more consistent, can actually help move the agenda forward.
That was Kandahar Sapati reporting. Every year, hundreds of dolphins are rounded up in Taiji, Japan, and are either slaughtered for their meat or sold to different theme parks around the world. Well, this is a practice that many countries have called inhumane. Countries, for example, like the United States, have banned the import of captive dolphins. Others, however, have not. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has been very busy to try to bring awareness to this and put an end to the practice, of which the Japanese government says this is a cultural tradition that is thousands of years old. But is it really? Well, to find out a little bit more about this year's hunt, we're now joined on the line in Japan by Melissa Siegel. She is in Taiji right now to document the hunt itself.
Well, Taiji continually keeps stating that it is a cultural thing and the drive hunts are tradition, that these dolphins are driven in mass quantities into the cove because they've been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. When in truth, the drive hunts originated in the late 1960s, right when the captive trade was booming. The captive trade industry, these dolphins that are bought and sold to marine parks around the world, is what continually funds the slaughter here. So we're seeing mass quantities of these dolphins being taken for a life of imprisonment and sold for hundreds of thousands of U.S. dollars. This pod of bottlenose dolphins over the weekend was a multi-million dollar profit for Taiji.
So you said, you know, this all started in the late 60s. I mean, before that, was there fishing in the area or did they just stop normal fishing because the fish stocks had dried up?
They have been, Taiji is a fishing town. It is, in history, it was a whaling town. But they discontinued the local whaling, and then they went to hunting dolphins. Now, the dolphin meat is not something that is in demand here, but the captive dolphins are. So that is where the money is coming from. three captive facilities here in Taiji. The trainers are the ones that work with the killers in the cove, hand-selecting these dolphins, the more beautiful ones, the more suitable ones for captivity. The ones that are not deemed suitable for captivity are the ones slaughtered for human consumption.
How do they bring all the dolphins into that area? Because, I mean, I can't just see the dolphins. They don't just migrate there. This is not something that they naturally do. They actually coax them in, right?
Well, there is the season begins September 1st through March 1st, and it is a dolphin migrating season. That is correct. But the dolphins are driven in by 12 killing boats that leave each morning Taiji Harbor in search of these dolphins and small whales. It's not just bottlenose dolphins. Well, they have driven in pilot whales and various species of dolphins. These killing boats will use metal poles and that are placed into the water, and they are hammered by the killers, which resonates a sound underwater used to frighten and manipulate these dolphins into swimming into shallow water. So the killers are able to drive these dolphins for miles towards the shore of Taiji into the cove. This sound is very deafening. They're not able to communicate with one another. And in turn, the killers are able to control mass quantities of dolphins and net them into the cove, where they are then in turn selected for captivity or slaughtered.
How many dolphins are captured and slaughtered each year?
Well, so far this season, the season has not ended. It goes until March. Since September 1st, over 1,200 dolphins have been driven into the tiny cove of Taiji. And not including today, which we are still reviewing our footage, but over 600-plus dolphins have been slaughtered since September 1st of last year.
That's a rather extraordinary amount.
Yeah, and of those, approximately 150 have been taken captive.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the past few days, we did try to get a comment from the Japanese government. They didn't return any of our emails and calls, which is not really surprising. In Taiji itself, what is the feeling about this? I mean, it mustn't be everybody that is in support of this, is there?
We were speaking to or in contact with local Japanese activists, and they're saying their media is very biased. The world was aware of the pod that was, you know, driven into the cove over the weekend, and that it was the largest pod of bottlenose dolphins, 250 plus. But Japanese media was not reporting that until days later after the fact. Nor did they say that the albino dolphin was taken from the cove. They said that it was found and rejected by its mother. So it's obviously not being reported, and it's very biased.
Now, just let me play the devil's advocate here for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could imagine that some people would probably say, you know, look, if we stop this, what do we do with the people here that would be not having this source of income?
Taiji is a very beautiful place. I mean, if you were to come here, you would think, God, this is such a beautiful place. Japan is a beautiful country. It's just tainted by the bloodshed here in Taiji. Taiji could be a very profitable tourist destination if they would just stop slaughtering dolphins. People would come here to scuba dive, see dolphins, dolphin sightseeing, swim with wild dolphins. I mean, it's a beautiful town that could be changed into an eco-tourist town. But unfortunately, they're not willing to make that change.
Now, there's, of course, a lot of people, you know, that are in the area that are saying, oh, you know, we sell the dolphin meat. But from the studies that I've read, dolphin meat has a high concentration of mercury. So where do they sell it?
Dolphin meat is sold all over Taiji, in adjacent towns throughout Japan. You can go into any tourist shop and see whale or dolphin meats, any grocery store, and it's clearly packaged from Taiji, often labeled as gondor meat, which is whale meat, depending on the species. And some of it is directly labeled as dolphin meat.
But aren't there people that are concerned about the health risks because of the high mercury?
I'm sure there is some, but people just seem to be oblivious of the danger of the mercury content, as they are oblivious to what is happening to these dolphins. Most people here locally are aware of what is happening. They just don't seem to care. Although I've spoken to Japanese citizens in Tokyo or the larger cities that are still not aware that this is actually happening here in their own country.
Now, you mentioned, of course, a moment ago that a lot of these dolphins are then sold to various water theme parks around the world. Who do you have any idea of who the biggest clients are?
There are various marine parks throughout Europe, throughout China, and in Japan, as far as Dubai. It is illegal to import the captive dolphins into the United States. But we have seen these dolphins travel for days. They are placed in tiny cargo crates, transported for days to the airport via just, you know, an 18-wheeler truck, and then flown for another couple of days to their destination. A lot of times these dolphins don't even survive from Taiji to where their destination is. You know, not only do these dolphins go through the drive hunt, the violent captive process, but being confined in tiny sea pens or tanks, and then eventually transported, sometimes for days and days, and then separated from their family and sent to a marine park. So it's very stressful for these dolphins.
So what then would be the next step? I mean, if this is the practice, of course, that everybody agrees has to end, I mean, how do you go about changing the minds of, let's say, the Japanese government, who are really the ones that can stop the practice?
Well, as you can see, the media is taking notice of this. You know, this weekend was, you know, the largest pod, but this has been going on for many years. And it's good to see media attention on this issue. It puts global pressure on the Japanese government to put an end to this. Caroline Kennedy has spoken up against this. The British ambassador has made a statement saying that it's completely inhumane. So as Sea Shepherd organization, we welcome and hope that more government high-ranking officials will make a stand and, you know, make a public statement against this, putting more global pressure on the Japanese government.
Have you yourself or other activists that are trying to stop this, have you ever come into trouble in Taiji, either them not letting you into Taiji or asking you to leave?
We are here, Sea Shepherd Cove Guardians are here abiding by Japanese law. We're not here to break the law. We're here to expose the daily atrocities that occur here in Taiji. We're documenting, we're live streaming every day, every slaughter, every transfer, for the world to see what is happening. We're not here breaking the law. We are continually monitored by various levels of police and Coast Guard 24 hours a day. There's many barricades, barriers, restricted areas that we're not allowed to enter across. Taiji uses tarps and police to hide what they are claiming as culture. So we're not here to break the law. We're just here to document it. And I don't feel... I myself do not feel threatened, but Taiji doesn't want Sea Shepherd here. They don't want us here with our cameras documenting what they're doing. But we're here until and we won't stop until the slaughter ends.
I suppose one of the areas that would help stop this actually is by changing the minds of Japanese people who either don't know what's going on or just don't know all the facts about what's going on.
Right, and various organizations are working to educate Japanese locals and educate them. And I think a combination of educating Japanese so they can rise up, and there is definitely more awareness here, demonstrations in the larger cities, in Tokyo, protesting the slaughter of dolphins, That was the first starting last year, which is a phenomenal awakening and change for Japan. And plus the increase in global pressure, government officials and celebrities coming together.
I suppose as well that pressure also has to be put on foreign governments. I mean, like you said, the United States has banned the import of captive dolphins. A lot of countries haven't. And of course, it's something that anybody can do in their own country. If there is a theme park, either don't go or you know, have somebody, you know, put pressure on them as well for buying these animals, because I don't think theme parks will say, oh, by the way, you know, we got these dolphins from Taiji where they kill 600 or so a year.
Right. And of course, they're not going to, you know, a lot of marine parks will deny and lie about where these dolphins come from. You know, like I had just mentioned, even here at Taiji Whale Museum said that this dolphin was rejected by its mother, when clearly we have footage that it was taken from the killing cove. It's important for people to make the connection by buying a ticket to a dolphin show or swimming with captive dolphins. They are directly supporting the slaughter here in Taiji.
One thing I'm really curious about, I mean, with the dolphins that are sold for different theme parks, are they sold directly by Taiji, or do they go through, let's say, third partners?
We've seen it occur both ways. The local trainers here and Taiji Fishermen's Union will select dolphins, and they're sometimes held here and conditioned and trained to, not only to eat dead fish for tricks, but trained to do various, you know, tricks, and then they're more profitable. And different species are sold for different prices. Now, we've seen transfers out of the country, done immediately with new captive dolphins. These dolphins are sold for a lesser price because they're not trained. Some of the captive facilities here in Taiji will train these dolphins and then sell them for a higher amount of money.
Melissa Siegel from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. A member of Nauru's opposition has been caught up in the island's judicial crisis, in which two top members of the judiciary were sacked. The resident's visa for Roland Kun's partner has been revoked, a move he views as a personal attack on him and his family. Mr. Kun's partner, Katie Leroy, is an Australian citizen. She has been sacked from her job as the parliamentary counsel, and her resident's visa has been cancelled without notice. Mrs. Leroy arrived in Australia in November for the birth of their third child. Like former residents Magistrate Peter Law and Chief Justice Jeffrey Emrams, who were fired from their jobs, Katie Leroy has been given no explanation for the action. Her husband, Roland Kun, speaks next to Geraldine Coutts in Melbourne.
It was during our time here that we were informed, not by government, but by friends on the island, that Cabinet had resolved to revoke Katie's visa. And, of course, since then, we still have not received any notice from government as to the decision. We've been able to confirm that they're implementing that resolution by us making communication with the airline, the sole airline that operates to Nauru, because the airline has been informed not to allow Katie into the country on the basis that her visa has been revoked.
All right, just to
clarify. No reason has been provided, and no reason, we don't expect that any reason will be provided, because there's no proper reason for it.
Well, just to clarify, you found out about it when you went to book seats to return home to Nauru, and the airline told you that your partner Katie was blacklisted.
No, we inquired with the we found out about it when people on the island told us of the cabinet resolution,
and it was confirmed
that
by
there
the airline.
Was a cabinet resolution. We then contacted the airline to confirm whether they've received any directive from government in that regard, and they confirmed that yes, they have, and that directive was that they were not to issue Katie a ticket to Nauru because she doesn't have visa.
Well, just the details now. You're obviously Nauruan. Your two oldest children were born on Nauru. The third one was born in Melbourne, and your partner Katie has a residence visa, which generally is just renewed automatically. So what does this do to your family if the mother of your three children, who are Nauruan, and yourself Nauruan, can't go home to Nauru?
Well, it puts us in great difficulty, and we believe that is more the point of the revocation of Katie's visa, is to put us into that difficulty and to put me as a member of the opposition into that difficulty, because effectively they've made it impossible for us to live together in the house that we're building on the island. And we've lived together for 6 years on the island, and we do have three kids, two, as you say, were born on Nauru, and only our last one now is born in Australia. But we are building a house on Nauru, and Katie doesn't have a home here. She's been living on Nauru for, like I say, over 6 years now, and they've put us in. This is, to me, a personal attack on me and my family by the government of Nauru.
Your partner's job was formerly as parliamentary counsel. She has been sacked from that job, and she's also had a visa revoked.
Yes, they removed her from as parliamentary counsel a couple of months back, and just recently they revoked her visa. And well, there's no reason for either, but the more recent is quite significant in terms of how it's going to impact on myself and my family.
Well, what steps have you taken now to try and sort this out?
We were going to file a matter with the court on Nauru, as Rod Henshaw had done in his own case. But now we're now reassessing how we move forward with that, considering that the government is not allowing the Chief Justice back on the island to hear matters.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program or have any story ideas, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Goodbye, everyone.